The Rise of Communism and Critique of Communism was presented by David Crabtree on August 11, 2009 at Gutenberg College's Summer Institute, Paychecks, Politics, and Paradigms. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2009. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. This recording was made in a classroom setting, and some of the questions were inaudible. It is hoped that the presenter's answers will be sufficient to understand the context.
I'm going to talk a little bit about Marx. I didn't really prepare a lot. Having been in college in the 70s, it seems to me that everybody should know Marx, but I know in talking to Gutenberg students, a lot of them have very little familiarity with Marxist theory. So it's a little hard to know at what level to talk about it, how much detail. So I think what I'll do is just give the short version of Marxist theory and then make a few comments about Marxism in general and its impact, and then can use questions to pursue things where you want to go, to the extent that I can answer. Marxist theory is all centered around this concept that over the span of time, not only is man evolving, but human society is evolving. As I mentioned, Marx really liked Hegel's idea of the dialectic. And he says that he took Hegel and he found Hegel standing on his head and Marx righted him. What he meant by that is Hegel thought that ideas are that which run history, that culture, politics, economics in any given time in history are the product of the way people think about things. So it's as ideas evolve, then everything else follows along, trails along, and changes accordingly. Marx said the dynamic is absolutely right. He's just got it upside down. That what actually drives history is the economic forces. It's the economic tensions that exist between the classes, and that everything else is the product of that, is the result of that. So culture and politics and even the ideas that you think are the product of that economic environment in which you live. They're shaped by that. So that has been a force that's been at work throughout all of the history of mankind. Man and culture are evolving over time, and there are stages that have happened. Sometimes you'll start with the ancient or the what he calls the Asiatic, but he doesn't really develop that very much. The first one that he develops very much is the medieval period. In the medieval period, you have the lords and you have the serfs. That's the economic environment. There are tensions. In every level, there are tensions that are latent in that economic system. And as that economic system continues to do its thing, work and operate, those tensions will begin to come to the surface and be felt more acutely. He calls them contradictions in the economic system. And those will be felt more acutely and eventually so acutely that it develops into conflict, social conflict, and eventually there will be a revolution. Marx thought that every time period ended with a revolution that was based on those antagonisms and contradictions. A revolution kind of clears the playing field, and then a new system will emerge that takes bits and pieces of what had existed in the previous system and starts to construct something wholly new. So the medieval system resulted in the revolution, which then propels you into the next period, which is capitalism. And there it's the conflict between the working class and the capitalists. The tensions become more acute, more pronounced, those contradictions. And then you have another revolution that takes you into the next period of history and, in fact, takes you to the end of history, which is socialism or communism. And that is the end of history. That he's projecting that into the future. That's what's going to happen. That's what he sees coming. And that, for the first time in history, will be an economic system in which there are no antagonisms because there's only one class. And that one class is the working class. And doing away with all of the antagonisms, all of the contradictions, that one is the first one that will be stable, and it will go on forever, and everything, everyone will live happily ever after. So that's Marx's perspective. In reading Marx, when I first read Marx, I was predisposed to think that everything he said would be garbage. But at the graduate level in reading Marx, I was actually amazed at what a good analyst he was of the situation in which he was living. That he was observing some things about the economic system that had come into being, this industrialized capitalistic system, that is truly amazing and very good observation. I highly recommend that you read the Communist Manifesto, because in that he explains some of the dynamics that are at work in capitalism, and I think he's absolutely right in his analysis of the way things were at the time that he was writing. He spent most of his time looking at the working class in England and studying the conditions there, but then he became intrigued with the situation in Russia because he had come into contact with some Russian revolutionaries who had come out of a whole different intellectual tradition and had some different ideas, but they had reached some conclusions that were similar to those of Marx, and they read Das Kapital and they said, he's nailed it. He understands things. So they came and they talked to Marx. Marx was very impressed with them. And in fact, after talking to them, he modified some of his views. Prior to talking to the Russians, he thought that the revolution would break out in the most advanced of the capitalist countries. So he was thinking probably England or Germany would be where this would happen. But then in talking to the Russians, he thought, my goodness, they understand this better than most intellectuals in Western Europe, and Russia had this communal tradition behind it, the obshchinas. And when he learned more about that, they were saying, well, that is going to be the basis out of which communism will develop. Rather than in the West, where they don't have that kind of tradition, how are they going to know how to do communism? Well, in Russia, we know how to do communism because we have the obshchina. The communes that serfs lived in on an estate. And there was a lot of communal sharing that took place in the obshchina. And so they said, the revolution's going to happen in the marginal areas. It's going to happen in the areas where industrialization is happening much more quickly and where there is that tradition of communal living. And there are indications that later in his life, Marx became convinced that they were right, that the revolution was going to happen in one of those areas that was trying to catch up rapidly with the industrialized world. So Marx spent a lot of time studying Russia. He learned Russian so he could study the situation in Russia. And he also studied India because he thought that there were some of the same things happening there. And he wanted to understand the dynamics of what was happening. But in the study of industrialization, one of the things that he recognizes is low prices, he says in the Communist Manifesto, low prices are the battering ram that will bring down the wall of China. What he means by that is industrialization and this move towards productivity and the ability to create goods very cheap is going to make it possible for goods to be exported all over the world. There is no area that will be able to resist those goods coming in. Let's do a little thought experiment, and I'll try to describe how this works. Let's imagine a society someplace up in the Himalayas, completely isolated from the rest of the world. There are people there that make blankets, and everybody who uses blankets there, and I suppose they need them, uses the domestically produced Himalayan blankets. Sooner or later, someone is going to come from the West, is going to make the hike up the Himalayas to that area because they're always in search for new markets. And they're going to want to sell blankets in this little area in the Himalayas. As they take those blankets up there, they are going to be cheaper than the ones that are domestically produced. Because there's some machine somewhere that's just whipping out those blankets faster and cheaper than it can be done by hand. So the domestic producers in the Himalayas are going to have one of two choices. Either they quit the business or they begin to produce them much more cheaply. And in order to produce them much more cheaply, they're going to have to imitate the factories in the West that are producing those. Let's say the government says, we're going to protect our domestic industry. We are going to ban any imports of those foreign blankets. If they do that, then the result will be they will fall further and further behind economically. And as they fall behind economically, they will fall behind militarily. And as they fall behind militarily, they become less survivable. So that Himalayan country has the choice. We either change and imitate the West, or we die. That's the choice that we're faced with. Cease to exist as a country, cease to exist as a distinct people, or we transform our economic system. And if you transform your economic system, that will require a transformation of the values and the culture that you live in. If you live in a culture that doesn't have a clock, you just go by where the sun is in the sky, that's going to change. You're going to get a clock because you need people to show up at the workplace on time, etc. And so what happens is capitalism, using its cheap prices, spreads itself and replicates itself worldwide. And it takes with it its a whole culture. And that is inevitable. It's going to happen. That was Marx's perspective. I think he's absolutely right. That's what we've seen. It was inevitable. It's such a powerful and dynamic force, it was going to duplicate itself worldwide. That analysis by Marx, I think, is phenomenal. To see that early is truly astounding. But Marx, as a prophet, his scores are not as high. He saw what was going to happen is capitalism was going to develop. Its productivity was going to continue to increase. The impetus was going to be for there to be fewer and fewer producers, but each producer was going to be larger and larger scale, such that as history moved on, capitalism was going to develop just a handful of huge monopolies that produced everything. And they were going to produce so much that their market could not buy them all. So the capitalism was going to face a problem of overproduction. And in the face of that overproduction, the contradictions, the antagonisms built into the system would become so pronounced that there would be a revolution that would break out somewhere. And as I mentioned earlier, early on he thought that would happen in the most industrialized countries. Later he modified that to one that was more rapidly industrializing. But it would break out somewhere, and then once it broke out somewhere, then it would spread worldwide. And so there would be a relatively rapid transformation from capitalism into socialism or communism. And for him, the terms were interchangeable. And then, once that spreads worldwide, then we will have an entirely new environment in which people are born and grow up, which means there will be a completely different culture. And there will be an economic system that, for the first time in human history, is thoroughly just and good. And in that system, then, there will be no tensions, and it will go on forever. That's not quite the way it worked out. The Soviet Union was the first place where a revolution occurred. The leaders of that revolution, I'm convinced, were firm believers in Marxist theory. Lenin, in particular, I think, was a thoroughgoing Marxist. But the problem was, Marx never developed exactly how you go from a capitalist country to this communism. He didn't spell out the steps. His perspective was, I don't know that I can see all those steps, but the working class, when it comes to the time, they'll know what to do. Well, it came to the time, and the revolution has happened, and Lenin's looking around, and he's saying, well, anybody got any good ideas? How are we going to do this? And they tried experiments They tried to just carry out a transformation of the environment, such as in the military, they did away with all ranks. In the symphony, no more conductors. Those experiments didn't last long. Russia was in a war at the time, so those were short-lived experiments. So no one knew how to make this transformation. And the problem, as Lenin looked at the situation, the problem was there were still bourgeoisie in their midst. There was still too much bourgeois culture. So we need to eliminate that. And eliminating that means eliminating people. And in a sense, it may be unfortunate, but they've got to go. We need to get the environment transformed so that we can have this complete transformation of our people. And several million people died trying to make this change the environment. So as a prophet, Marx was not very good. But as an analyst, I think he was outstanding. Some of the impacts of Marxist thought that continue to a certain extent even to this day, I would say, and I'm just going to list a few. One is that huge forces are at work in history such that any individual shrinks into insignificance. That's certainly the Marxist way of looking at the world, that individuals don't much matter. There are these bigger forces that are actually at work. And those big forces are so big, and they are impersonal, and they shrink anyone into insignificance. And that's very important, and that's a big shift from the way that people looked at history prior to Marxism. In fact, when I was in college, my professors would derisively talk about the historians of the 18th century, for instance, as kings and battles historians, because they would just focus on key individuals and key events as being the determiners of history. And of course, all of my professors were, to one degree or another, Marxist, and they would dismiss that. That's silliness, because people don't determine history. Forces determine history. That's really important and significant in thinking about Marxism, because one of the reasons that a Lenin could condemn to death a lot of capitalists is because they aren't really people. They're just manifestations of these forces. Marxist theory really depersonalizes individuals, and that made it easier for them to use harsh measures in trying to transform the climate and the culture. Marxism would say that nothing is fixed, everything is in flux. My professors would say there is no such thing as human nature. That's not a fixed thing. There's no such thing. Human nature is an ever-changing thing. You can only talk about the nature of human beings today, but that doesn't mean that it'll be the same as tomorrow. That ideas and culture are the product of economics is another, I would say, to a large extent, it's a common perspective even today, even though Marxism is, to a large extent, on the wane. That there's still the perspective that criminals, for instance, are a product of their environment, not a product of their choices, it's a product of their environment. So what they need is rehabilitation, not punishment. They need to be in another environment. And the idea that the driving force behind history is class conflict has been a huge factor in politics worldwide. That even people who aren't, I think, true Marxists have used this as a vehicle to propel them into political power. It is a wonderful political tool to be able to appeal to the majority of the population and say, you are being treated unfairly, and I will make things right. You can always get a lot of people who will resonate that you're getting the shaft. And politicians have done that worldwide. And it's also convenient that once the revolution called for by Marxist theory comes about, that in practice you're going to need a strong centralized force to transform it into the socialist system that's going to be. And as a result, that's attractive to politicians as well. I can appeal to the unfairness that they're experiencing right now to get them on board. And then once we bring about the change, I have a reason to consolidate power in my hands in order to transform this. It ought to be in what the goal that we want to achieve. So Marxism has been appealed to by a lot of revolutionaries who want to grab control in their society and have power centralized in their hands. We've seen that repeated time after time throughout the world. Okay, that's all that I had prepared. Willing to entertain questions or comments.
From a scientific perspective, how would we know if communism doesn't work? Is there a null hypothesis?
From a scientific perspective, what do you mean by that?
I would look at the history of communism and socialism and say it's a horrible flop. It's created nothing but poverty, misery, death, destruction, alienation. Would they say, yeah, so? That doesn't mean it's failed. How would you know if it's failed? If it was a great theory, but when it encountered the real world, we discovered, oh, well, it's not really based on the real world because it fails out there. How would we know? How would they know?
Well, I would guess what they would say is, from my perspective, did things unfold the way that Marx had predicted that they would unfold? If his theory is correct, and if it's true that one can project from it into the future, did that work? I would say no, but a thoroughgoing Marxist, one who wants to hold tenaciously to that, would say, how do we know? Maybe not yet. There's still time. But otherwise, all you could do would be to go back and look at history and say, did things unfold the way that Marx said they unfolded? And there has been a huge amount of controversy over the French Revolution. Was the French Revolution, did it fit the pattern of what Marx said it would fit? And Marx looked at the French Revolution. That was one of the revolutions that was foremost in his mind. And he saw that as paradigmatic of a transformation from a feudal system, a dying feudal system, to a capitalist system that had the seeds in it of going even further to a communist system, but the capitalists crushed it and it settled in as a capitalist system. So there would be the question, did he treat that data fairly? Was he looking at that fairly? Both sides of the question.
Quick follow-up to that question. Work that you would recommend, let's say, maybe a contemporary Marxist analysis of the failure of the Soviet project? Any work that you would recommend? Are there Marxists today trying to explain why communism didn't work in Soviet Russia that we could read? Anything that you would recommend?
I don't know. There's a book called The Turning Point that was written by a Russian author, and I can't remember his name, that deals with some of this.
From a Marxist perspective?
From a Marxist perspective.
I can imagine that the capitalists are lining up to explain why this failed. But I'm just curious if there are Marxists out there.
Are defending the Marxist system.
Well, that would say that, this is still can be accounted for from a Marxist perspective.
I'm not aware of anyone who's done that. But The Turning Point is a book written by some Soviet economists who are trying to explain what happened in the collapse of the Soviet Union. My recollection is they aren't really taking a stance pro-Marxist or anti-Marxist. They're just saying, here are the problems that were built into the Soviet system that resulted in this collapse. There are some works, however, that were written in the mid-1900s, 1950s, 1960s, that are arguing that socialist theory will always result in authoritarianism. And those books are interesting. One of them is by Talman, and another one is by Hannah Arendt. Both of those are very interesting. Yes?
Going back to your thought experiment about your Himalayan culture, yes, tribe. Well, here's the way my thinking goes. It seems to me that our foreign policy seems to, like you had admired Marx's analysis in that regard, and is trying to do just about exactly what you're saying with countries like Afghanistan and others who happen to be in the Himalayas. And yet, my analysis or my observation is that it's not working particularly like predicted there. And I'm wondering if you might comment on how an Islamic culture might throw the curve into that analysis, or I look at it particularly from the value standpoint of, yes, you can export capitalism, you can export the economy, but that doesn't necessarily mean you will export a Western worldview with it, or the values necessary to sustain the kind of economy that we're thinking or hope for.
I think what you're talking about is our foreign policy of spreading democracy. Is that primarily what you have in mind? It seems to me that the capitalist system has been pretty successful in going into these other cultures and replicating itself. There are some cultures that are more resistant to it than others. A culture that really values highly its traditions and its set of mores is going to be resistant to the transformations that capitalism requires in order to be as efficient as it is in the West. We in the West have been extremely receptive to what Jacques Ellul calls technique, methods, and with that comes technology. We adopt those things without even blinking. It's like if it's new and it's more efficient, we embrace it and say, wonderful. There are other cultures that are more resistant to that because they see that that means that there will be changes in the way that they live on a day-to-day basis, and they aren't sure that they want to make those changes. In fact, in all of the developing countries, there's some resistance there to one degree or another. They aren't convinced that just because you can produce more, you'll have a better life. They like the way that things are. So a society that really values these other things, these non-monetary goods, is going to be more resistant to capitalism coming in. But I think that there is something about the attractiveness of stuff that will eventually triumph even in those cultures that are initially resistant to it. And by eventually, I think that can take a number of years. But even Muslim areas, I think, it may be that the rise of Islamic fundamentalism, that people would embrace the values of traditional Islam so fully that they would refuse to make a change. I suppose that's possible. But as I look at the Islamic fundamentalists, they aren't completely averse to technology and embracing technique. I mean, they use cell phones, they use plastic explosives. So they aren't completely averse to the modern world and what it has to offer. And once you start capitulating on those things, it's a difficult dam to plug with your finger. So I think in the long run, I think it is just too attractive to human beings as human beings that you have the opportunity to have more stuff. That's just attractive. And that, from my perspective, that's the scariest, because it seems to me that capitalism only really works with a moral base. If it doesn't have a moral base, it becomes something that we wouldn't even recognize as capitalism. And it's like what I was saying yesterday, it's more like opportunism, that it becomes this game. How do I get more out of you than you get out of me? And there are all kinds of tricks involved in that and abuses of the concept of fair trade, and it becomes something that's actually very ugly. But I think that just as I would argue that democracy requires the same thing in order to work. And you take the system of democracy and you put it in a culture with a different set of values, and democracy is going to look different. It's going to work differently. And it's not going to be as good a system as what we have been fortunate to have. I think the same thing happens with capitalism. You take that institution away from the culture in which it developed and which gave it the values that undergird it, and you put it on something else, and it's going to look very different and is far less benign. But it nevertheless has that replicating ability, and I think the capitalist system is going to replicate itself and spread even in the absence of those underlying values that keep it within certain constraints.
Thank you very much for this morning, David. Did I hear you say, just in passing, something along the lines of you think Marxism is on the wane these days? Would you mind fleshing that out a little bit, talking about your observations that would lead to that conclusion and your thinking and that kind of thing?
Well, in Western culture, Marxism was fashionable, highly fashionable, before the 50s. And most intellectuals in Western Europe, and it even had a huge impact in America. But once some of the abuses of Stalinism became known, there were a lot of people that began to have second thoughts about it. And it became less fashionable as time went on, and it became clearer that the Soviet Union was not the paradise and was not becoming the paradise that people thought it would be. People became Maoists, and then instead of Leninists, and you switch countries to one that's less familiar and therefore could be more idealistic about. But we've kind of run out of places. And since the fall of the Soviet Union, I think a lot of people in the West have decided that Marxism was not the silver bullet. And it would just be my observation. When I was doing graduate work at the university, and that was only, 20 years ago, 20 to 15 years ago, all of my professors were heavily influenced by Marxist thought. But the transformation that's happened in the generation of teachers is the newer ones are not Marxists at all. They're postmodern, which has carried some things over from Marxism, but it really is a different beast. And that seems to come to predominate at this point.
I have a question about what insights you think Jesus might have if he were here today and could look back and talk with us about what we've seen over the last 200 years. What fundamental insights would he have on communism, good or bad, and maybe on capitalism too?
I think I'll just speak for God. Boy. Well, this is the kind of question that probably would require more thought to give a good answer to. But I think that in general, Jesus wouldn't have entered into the debate, because my own perspective, and I think it's Jesus's as well, and God's, is that I think that there is much that is good in capitalism. I would agree with Adam Smith that it is an amazing thing. You just kind of stand back and look at it and go, wow, that is an amazing thing. But it is not inherently amazing. I think capitalism works and only really works when it is operative in an environment which embraces values that are biblical values. It is not inherently a good system, but it is a good system in the context of those kinds of values. I would say the same thing with democracy. It's not inherently a good system, but in an environment where there are good values, it works really well, and in fact, better than some other things. But there are other things that might work also. And that Jesus' emphasis is he's constantly focusing on what are those values? What ought we to value? What is worth living for? What's worth dying for, and what isn't? And capitalism and communism both have a tendency to emphasize to too great a degree stuff. And I think that Jesus' perspective was stuff is not what it's about. There are more important things in this world, far more important things, and we need to take those seriously and think about those things. But if you were to ask him, do you think capitalism is a good economic system? I think you'd say, yeah, given the right values, it works well. And communism, stupid idea. That's fantasy. There is a lot of arrogance. Well, actually, in both systems, there can be a lot of arrogance. That's true.
This may be a better question for later in the week, but I'm curious. It seems like the West right now is moving in a more towards socialism, both in the West, or both, especially in Europe, but more so in America. What's different between the socialism that we're heading towards now and what Marx was envisioning?
What's happening now is less ideologically driven, it seems to me. Marx had this whole view of history and the inevitability of history and where things were going, and he thought he could see where things were going, and he wanted to give people a nudge to move in that direction. And it was much more grandiose, it was much more laid out than what is happening now. What's happening now is more an ad hoc response to various problems. And as we respond to the various problems, what we do is we say, well, those problems are best solved by the state and by society as a whole. And that's more and more our impulse. And I think that's a very natural impulse, that as human beings, we know that we are living in a universe that is dominated by forces that are bigger than we are and could crush us in an instant. So we are always in the market for the biggest, baddest guy that we can get to be on our side. And the biggest, baddest guy that we can see around us is the state. So to enlist the state to be my protector is a very attractive thing. And I think that, too, is irresistible in the long run. Just like stuff is irresistible to us in the long run, having a protector that's the biggest, baddest guy around and to one degree or another is responsive to me, that's what I want. And in the past, culture was, especially American culture, was dominated by the idea that God played that role, that there was no force here in our culture and society that played that kind of role. But that is dissipating. So we're in the market for something else, and the state is the best candidate for that. So I think that's the impetus behind what's going on. And what's interesting is I was talking with a friend of mine who's a doctor several years back, and he was asking me how the Soviet healthcare system worked. And so I was telling him all that I knew, which didn't take very long. But then he just sat back in his chair and he said, that's interesting, because a lot of that is happening through insurance here. And we talked a little bit more about that and the tendency for the private sector to respond to some of those same kinds of desires for security and stuff that Marxism, at least in the Soviet Union, the state provided. There's just that huge appeal to us to have some big force that will defend us. And the more secular we become, the more that becomes a worldly force that we're looking at. So I think that's what's happening, and I think it's fairly inevitable. But when we get to Hayek, we can talk about that more. Okay?